What's going on, man? Well, I suppose actually you should be asking me that.
What's going on, bro?
Well, Senator Clinton, the wonderful, wonderful and scary, scary Madam Clinton admits that the fraudulent drug war is all about money. And what is now being dubbed one of the most incoherent and nonsensical statements to be made by a politician in recent days concerning the drug war, US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently told Mexican reporters that drugs like marijuana can never be legalized because, quote, there is just too much money in it, displaying a complete lack of understanding concerning basic economics and simple common sense. Clinton foolishly tried to claim that legalization would benefit drug lords, despite the fact that simple supply and demand proves otherwise. Quote unquote, you can legalize small amounts for possession, but those who are making so much money selling, they have to be stopped, she said. They can't be given an even easier road to take because they will then find it in their interest to addict even more young people. On the contrary, legalization, every time it's been happening, you know, for example, during the prohibition years when alcohol became legal again, it actually drives down the price, which would in turn be a disincentive to drug lords to continue selling as they currently do, instead of all the violence and corruption that currently takes place in the black market of drug dealing. Legal dealers would have little reason to resort to such violence, such actions in normal market settings. I don't know about you, Daryl, but I haven't seen two liquor shop owners like trying to shoot each other over over who sells the most beer. You know what I'm saying? It just doesn't happen in a legal market. That only happens when the market is illegal, which is the entire reason why it is. Thank you very much. Wonderful violence and all of that kind of stuff provides a great justification for giving the police more powers and taking the rights off the people anyway, which was the reason why drugs were made illegal in the first place, allegedly. Clinton evidently does not understand that there is so much money to be made by selling illegal drugs precisely because they are illegal, writes Jacob Sullum in an article at Reason.com. Prohibition not only enables traffickers to earn a risk premium that makes drug prices much higher than they would otherwise be, it delivers the highly lucrative business into the hands of criminals who, having no legal recourse, resolve disputes by spilling blood. Several pro-legalization groups have also come out against Clinton, calling her statements ignorant and preposterous, noting that if someone like Sarah Palin had said such things, she would have immediately been the laughingstock of the media. Others say that Clinton's statements were not birthed out of ignorance, but rather a clear reflection of central government efforts to protect the illegal drug market. A 1998 PBS investigation, for instance, explains how the US Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, relies on international drug dealing to finance covert operations, which offers insight into the real reason for the war on drugs. Now, one aspect of that, they do finance covert operations by running drugs. For example, the world's largest CIA base outside of Langley, Virginia, is in Afghanistan, and they are making heroin. Lots of it.
For sure. Yeah.
Afghanistan used to produce 1% of the world's heroin supply under the anti-drug Taliban. It now produces 98% of the world's heroin supply under the pro-drug US administration dictator Hamid Karzai, former UNICAL advisor.
So that must be why they didn't like the Taliban, perhaps, and although, you know, they go against Western sort of sensibilities and stuff, and it was pretty easy to market, you know, a war against the Taliban, but that was their reason, wasn't it, really?
Well, there's many, many reasons. Number one, they needed a pipeline to ship things through the Caspian Sea down to the Gulf of Aden, and the Taliban wouldn't sign the agreement to allow the pipeline through their territory. So, naturally, after the Taliban were removed, a UNICAL advisor on the pipeline, Hamid Karzai, was then appointed as the president of Afghanistan. And so, the very next day, he signed the pipeline deal.
Convenient.
Oh yeah, absolutely convenient. There's no conspiracy going on here whatsoever. In other news, Then this is another freaky one about false flag terrorism. It's been confirmed that an FBI got a warning a day before the Oklahoma City bombing. New documents released under the Freedom of Information Act confirm that the FBI received a phone call the day before the Oklahoma City bombing warning that the attack was imminent and that the Fed tried to reach a deal with bomber Terry Nichols to take the death penalty off the table if he admitted to making the call. The documents were released to Salt Lake City lawyer Jesse Trentadue, who in the course of a 15-year battle in trying to ascertain why his brother was tortured to death during an FBI interrogation related to the case, has all but proven the attack on Alfred P. Murrah Building was an inside job run by FBI agents who were handling Timothy McVeigh. What that indicates to me, quote from the lawyer, is that there is a record somewhere of that phone call and the FBI needs to explain it, said Trentadue in an interview with KTOK News. If the call was from one of the informants with McVeigh, clearly they had knowledge of the bombing and didn't stop it. And incidentally, alcohol, tobacco and firearms employees were also called by the FBI, apparently, and told to stay away that day. And not a single one of them died in the bombing, incidentally, because they were all off sick. The Fed's attempt to make Nichols accept responsibility for the phone call occurred in 2005 after Nichols had was visited by an attorney named Michael Selby, who claimed he was working for the government and would guarantee Nichols was spared the death penalty if he played ball in covering up FBI foreknowledge and involvement in the bombing plot. This was the first I'd ever heard of such a telephone call having been made, said Nichols in an affidavit recently filed in Utah, U.S. District Court. And I told Mr. Selby that as well as the fact that I had not made that telephone call. Selby also tried to get Nichols to reveal the location of a box of explosives that the FBI failed to find during an initial search of Nichols' home in 1995. He was fearful the FBI would come into possession of it and that no one would ever know who else was involved, said Trentadue. And his fears proved true because the FBI apparently found out that the box of explosives hidden in the basement of Nichols' homes, they basically found it and nothing's been released. McVeigh and Nichols' fingerprints were found on the box, along with the fingerprints of at least two other individuals whose names were redacted by the FBI. the cover-up. And the most this is the most hilarious story of the day. Man, I have not seen something this funny in a long time.
Go on.
Treated to fake rice made from plastic. This is from gorillamedia.co.nz.
Hey.
China's history with food safety is a rocky one, but even in the annals of robbery and abuse, this will go down in infamy. Various reports in Singapore media said that the Chinese companies are mass-producing fake rice, in part made out of plastic, according to the online publication Very Vietnam. The rice...
That is just crack-up. That is...
Yeah, it's made by mixing potatoes, sweet potatoes, and plastic. The potatoes were first formed into the shape of rice grains, and industrial synthetic resins are then added to the mix. The rice reportedly stays hard even after being cooked. The Korean language weekly Hong Kong reported that the fake rice is being sold in the Chinese town of Taiyun in Shaanxi province. A Chinese restaurant association official said that eating three bowls of this fake rice would be like eating one plastic bag. Due to the seriousness of the matter, he added that there would be an investigation of factories alleged to be producing the rice, Very Vietnam noted. Unfortunately, it's not the first time fake rice has been sold in China, according to China's Global Times. Previously, a company in Xi'an, Shaanxi province, had added flavoring to ordinary rice to synthesize Wuchang rice, which is regarded to be the best rice in the country. About 300,000 people were injured, and at least 6 infants died in 2008 when Chinese milk and infant formula was found to be adulterated with melamine, which was thought to help pass nutritional tests. And later that year, melamine was also discovered in Chinese eggs. And guess who signed off the document approving melamine to be added into the baby formula?
Barbara Bush.
Nope. You guessed it. Fonterra executives.
Oh, there's a surprise.
Oh, yeah. It's state Fonterrorism. Now, speaking of state Fonterrorism, Gough says the foreshore seabed process is an absolute disgrace. The government is being accused of ramming through foreshore seabed legislation and blocking a parliamentary committee's access to legal advice. Now, anybody who knows how our government operates knows that the government ramming through legislation without proper due process is not out of the ordinary. In fact, I would probably call it the norm. The Marine and Coastal Area, or Tukatai Marana Bill, was reported back today by Parliament's Māori Affairs Committee more than 2 weeks before it is due on February 25. The committee made no changes to the bill and recommended it be passed without amendments. And this is despite 4,455 written submissions and 1,520 form submissions. Basically, that overwhelmingly opposed the legislation. So, if you've got legislation that nobody likes, you know the best thing to do is ignore them completely and pass the bill anyway.
Well, it's like when we had that referendum over here and then they ignored it.
Which one was this?
Anti-smacking one, wasn't it?
As far as I know, there were three referendums that got ignored. Thank you very much.
In New Zealand.
What
were the three referendums?
I can't remember specifically. One was the smacking bill. What was the other one? The other was the foreshore seabed bill. And I forget what the third one was.
If you know what it was, text in 022-01 Bush. 022-01-26674.
Yeah, well, that was
and you
a
win
very
a little prize.
Nice if we had some fab. Yeah, a little.
You win a date with DJ Calamity, who's up next after this news broadcast.
Alright, speaking of it being 9:11 a.m, quote unquote from Gough, this has been an absolute disgrace in terms of democratic process. They will not even provide the legal advice given to the government to say what this bill actually means. And if you want to know what the bill actually means, go on YouTube and search Tūmeke foreshore seabed submission. A little video I made from Tim Selwyn from Tūmeke.com given to the commission. Now, Green Party co-leader Maturia Ture, who sat on the Māori Affairs Committee, said the process had been a complete farce, with the committee having no access to legal advice. And of course, the only reason why that was is because the government denied them that. We weren't able to make an amendment to the legislation, and it has just been rushed by National and the Māori Party, she said. Now, I would wonder why ACT leader Rodney Hyde said he was surprised the committee reported so early and assumed it was because of Māori Party strife with MP Honi Harawira when the Super City legislation was rammed through with Rodney Hyde as the local government minister with zero foresight or accountability. I wonder what he's complaining about. Why would he? You know, wouldn't he say this is great? He only received 16 hours notice. The entire public New Zealand only received, like, what, 20 minutes notice? Oh, I love that.
The depravity.
The what?
It's just depraved, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think it was Mark Twain that said that, what is it? Politics is the entertainment branch of government. Sounds about right to me.
Spot on.
Well, I am just basically pretty freaked out by the whole thing, because the upshot is, and this is the thing that you won't find in the news, unfortunately, is that it means that foreign powers will be able to come in and buy up the foreshore and seabed and take it out of Crown control. In fact, it removes all Crown control, conceivably, from the foreshore areas. This is extremely freaky and, in my opinion, an attack to our sovereignty. Now,
wouldn't it just end up sort of in private hands, pretty much like the rest of the land, and then, you know, people will be sectioning bits off? Is that what you're saying?
Well, conceivably. It may be even worse. We just don't know, because we're not allowed to see what's in it. And also, in other news, praise for crew after emergency landing. Passengers on the plane that sparked an emergency at Blenheim Airport when its nose wheel failed praised the pilot and crew for a surprisingly smooth landing. The Air Nelson Bombardier Dash 8 plane, which was carrying 44 people from Hamilton to Wellington, diverted to Blenheim Airport yesterday afternoon after suffering a nose wheel failure. And good on to those fellas too. And apparently the passengers were basically just taken off the plane and then bussed to the nearest airport, which was their destination originally. Now, committee postpones decision on Harawira. This one from stuff.co.nz. Apparently, Harawira may be off the hook for now. The ongoing dispute between Māori Party and Hone Harawira is experiencing, well, shall we say, it's on ice for now. Harawira faced a Māori Party disciplinary committee meeting in Wellington last night after he was suspended from the party caucus on Monday. The meeting found no resolution to the dispute, which had been called to decide on a formal complaint against Harawira by party whip Te Uroroa Flavel. Yesterday morning, hours before the hearing, Harawira lashed out again, criticising the Māori Party's ties with the National Party. But after the meeting late last night, he said he had agreed to stand down from any further media comment on the matter until it was resolved. However, he said he had reaffirmed in the meeting his position to the constitutional process and his preference for a kaupapa Māori process. But in spite of my opposition, the process was started and discussions were held in an open manner, Harawira said. The meeting adjourned after 5 hours of discussion. It was agreed that Harawira would hold a hui with his Te Kai Tokoro electorate committee this weekend and that the disciplinary committee would reconvene, possibly next week. So, the wonderful Hone Harawira is off the hook, conceivably, and goodness knows what the heck is going on. And it's alleged that the reason why, of course, as we read before, that the foreshore seabed submissions are being wiped aside and the legislation is being passed through is because of this one guy having a little bit of trouble in the Māori Party. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, that must be the reason.
Well, it certainly seems like a bit of a smokescreen, doesn't it? Sort of.
Yeah.
You're in trouble, go to the headmaster, don't worry what we're doing with the other hand.
Yeah, well, smokescreens happen all the time. Allegedly, you remember last year when Paul Henry got in a big trouble over racism and that kind of stuff, right?
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, apparently during that period of time, the government rammed through legislation to change food labelling standards, essentially saying that if you had a label on your olive oil saying it's 100% olive oil, the requirement in order to back up that 100% olive oil claim is that you had to have 1% olive oil.
That makes no sense.
And so now, the olive oil in most supermarket shelves, allegedly, this has not been confirmed yet, is in fact not olive oil at all. It's actually an industrial lubricant known as canola oil, which is a waste product offshoot of the production of seed oil. All done under the watchful eye of our fabulous media. And Aucklanders are set to benefit from the leftovers of supermarkets and food retailers with a free store sets are open in West Auckland next week for a one-month trial. And my executive producer on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will knows who these people are, and in fact is helping them to set this up. The free store will allow the concept of a similar store opened in Wellington's Cuba Mall last year, which sells leftover but edible products from retailers and growers to the community. Anybody who's familiar with supermarkets at all would understand that the vast, that huge track of frickin' food gets dumped every day and just allows to rot. There's a whole bunch of community of people called dumpster divers who actually go around and collect all this good food that is easy to eat and all that kind of stuff, and just gets chucked out and allowed to rot. And apparently this free store is an extremely popular idea. The West Auckland store, which opens on Monday, will be open to anyone in the community, but particularly to people struggling to pay their weekly food bill, but unwilling or ineligible to access a food bank, which basically means that if you're a pensioner or a student, or even if you're just a family who's struggling to make ends meet, which I'd probably say is the majority of Auckland families at the moment.
Yep.
You can go to this West Auckland store and get yourself some free food. Lou Lanani from the Community Development Arts and Culture Team of Auckland Council said the items sold would include those with reject packaging, misshapen food, damaged items, bakery items, cereal, coffee and produce. Leanne said supermarkets, small food retailers, growers and producers were all on board. We have even had donations of produce from the gardens at Henderson Primary School, she said. There is also expected to be large artistic components to the store, including a sculpture created by Henderson Primary School students from waste food packaging. This is an exciting concept to bring to Auckland, and we're proud to be doing the trial in Waitakere. It will be very interesting to see how the community responds, Vanessa Neeson, chair of the Henderson Massey local board, said. I thought that was very nice, you know. And also, in other worse news, Inglesey's slow recovery for the jobless. This is, of course, amid the government firing 5% of government employees. Finance Minister Bill English is softening up the public for a slow recovery in job numbers. When they say slow recovery, they mean mass unemployment. With a warning that the export sector may not deliver a big lift despite record prices for commodity exports. But Prime Minister John Key sounded a more upbeat note, saying, "I'm as confident as I can be with the information I have in front of me that the employment markets will improve over the next 12 months. This is, of course, after the fact that he said he would make unemployment dwindle under his leadership, and it has only increased. Mr. Key pointed to Auckland Dole figures, which he said showed a fall in numbers collecting the unemployment benefit. Auckland leads, it's starting to build some momentum."
So hold on. So we have an increase in unemployment and a decrease in payments from work and income.
Only in the Auckland region.
Right.
Yeah. Mr. English, took a more cautious tone, telling a parliamentary committee yesterday that the export or tradables sector employed far fewer people than the domestic economy, so could not deliver the boost. Just had to get a plug in there to jobs that came during the boom years of from 2003 till 2009, which are interestingly enough pretty dang good at getting the whole country massively in debt. Unemployment rose to 6.8% at the end of 2010, which is a huge figure, because we're normally like hovering around like 4% or something. Mr. English said the economy may have shrunk in the last quarter, delivering a double-dip recession. And for those of you who are unaware of how the global economy is working, or rather not working, we're not going to have a double-dip recession. We are going to have a double-trouble depression. And you will pay through the frickin' nose for your food, your petrol, which will jump up the price of absolutely everything. Unless you have no place to grow a garden, start growing one now, because at least those food prices won't go up because you'll be able to grow them. Now, after the latest household labour force survey showing unemployment had lifted to just under 7%, there was more bad news yesterday. New figures show that an extra 1,000 people had signed up for the dole last month. See, now this is the interesting thing about the government, right? John Key says, oh, well, you know, it's really good. We're having a great recovery, blah, 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 blah. Look at the slight decrease in people joining the dole line in Auckland. And then they say, well, 1,000 extra people just signed up for the dole over the whole country last month. What the heck are you talking about? It's basically BS. Social Development and Employment Minister Paula Bennett said the number of people on all benefits rose by 0.4% to 354,058, with 1,003 new people on the unemployment benefit. Mr. English said the normal factors that lifted the economy out of recession were absent: credit growth, house price rises, and strong consumer confidence. The tradable or export sector had added 25,000 jobs during the 2009 to 2010 year, a 6% increase. But growth of 2% in the non-tradable area had only seen 35,000 new jobs as households curbed spending and cut debt. Well, I would hasten to guess that the only reason why they had to curb their spending is because the food and fuel prices are getting astronomically out of control. And I wonder how in the F they can cut their debt, which actually kind of dovetails with the second article here. High prices fuel card spending. Higher food and petrol prices may be behind a sharp lift in card spending in January, according to some economists. Spending on credit cards rebounded sharply in January with a 2.2% jump in the value of total transactions, making for the biggest lift in 5 years. So on the one hand, the media is telling everybody is cutting down on their debt, and on the other hand, the media is telling everybody that they're spending up large on their credit cards. Can you make the connection? Spending in the core retail sector, which excludes vehicle-related industries, rose 2.4%, the largest increase since December 2002, according to Statistics New Zealand.
It's just madness, isn't it? Maybe we should just call this circus news, you know?
Well, it's Mr. News. Thank you very much. ANZ economist said the figures suggested the retail sector was on the road to recovery. the BS. Almost as onto the road to recovery as the Egyptian parliament is, as strikes erupt despite the Egyptian vice president's warnings that strikes and protests will no longer be tolerated, and more people flooded the streets than ever before. Are these people retarded? You know? I mean, what are you thinking, mate? There's 4 million people on the streets, and you think when you tell them, oh, we won't tolerate you protesting anymore, that they'll stop? Come on. Smoke some more hashish, man. Apparently they grow some really good stuff around there. All right. Now, another hypocritic news. Council doesn't have to accept Māori board, says Rodney Hyde. I say, well, Rodney, seeing as you're so against Māori seats, why don't you just ram through some legislation that nobody wants and nobody voted for and virtually the entire populace is opposed to again? You know, it's within your power. Local Government Minister Rodney Hyde is distancing himself from the $3.4 million cost to Auckland ratepayers to run the Māori statutory board set up under his name. If that's a statistic, I got a statistic for you. 75% of the totally unelected and totally unaccountable and privately run CCO models, basically they take about 75% of all the ratepayers' money and get to spend it however the F they want with zero oversight, which I don't think benefits the 100% of Aucklanders who never got a say. Now, speaking of this, state-owned enterprises and privatisations will attract foreign institutions, according to AMP Capital. And, of course, they're a wonderful little advisement group that have something to gain from the privatisation in the first place, so this is unsurprising. A partial float of the state-owned electricity generators would attract institutional and foreign investor support, especially if local investors had trouble digesting the size of the proposed float, says AMP Capital Investors New Zealand head of equities Guy Iliff. And this is not a good thing, by the way. When foreigners own your country, how much of your country do you own?
And we'll leave you with that thought. Vinny, we're out of time, man. That was a 30-minute section. Vincent will be back tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And thanks a lot, man.
You're very welcome. And ladies and gentlemen, today on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, starting at midday, where you can listen in live, we have a lady named Glendine Grant, who exposed a human trafficking ring, and a man named Gordon Israel, who is fighting the government in the courts, basically claiming that their entire legal system is fraudulent, which I happen to agree with. We'll see you there.
All right. Thank you very much. See you later, man.
See you, mate.
All right. It's time for the DJ, the one like Calamity. You've had